Today is Wednesday, June 3rd, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover the Iran-U.S. standoff and the threat to close the Strait of Hormuz, NATO's operational repositioning on the Baltic flank, and the attrition mathematics of Russia's war in Ukraine. Numbers that tell a story of strategic self-destruction. Iran has announced the termination of all nuclear negotiations with Washington. At the same moment, President Trump posted on Truth Social that talks were continuing at a rapid pace. Both things cannot be simultaneously true in the conventional sense, and yet that contradiction is precisely the point. This is not a communications failure. This is coercive diplomacy operating on two levels at once. Tehran's public announcement serves multiple audiences simultaneously. For the hardliner coalition at home, it signals that the regime is not capitulating under fiscal pressure. For Washington's Gulf allies and energy markets, it introduces maximum uncertainty at the worst possible moment. And crucially, it preserves off-ramps, a reversible diplomatic instrument that Tehran can walk back without conceding ground. Trump's concurrent claim of back-channel progress, sourced through CNN reporting cited on the Rubin Report, suggests those channels are very much alive, even as the surface rhetoric burns hot. Building on that, the fiscal dimension here is not peripheral, it is central. Iran is losing an estimated $500 million per day in oil export revenue under the U.S. naval blockade. That figure requires independent verification against IEA or EIA data. But even as an indicative estimate, it describes a runway that is finite and deteriorating. The Trump administration's posture of feigned indifference, what you might call maximum pressure at higher kinetic intensity than the first term, is a calculated bet that Iranian fiscal resilience will erode before U.S. domestic political will does. More importantly, the Lebanon dimension is the most structurally destabilizing variable in this equation. The ceasefire framework apparently failed to specify explicit geographic and actor scope, leaving ambiguous whether Israeli operations in Lebanon constituted violations of an arrangement originally framed around Iran. That definitional gap has handed Tehran a politically usable pretext for negotiation exit. It is domestically defensible, it is diplomatically ambiguous, and it is historically familiar. The Libya 2011 experience demonstrated that multi-party frameworks without precise actor definitions fracture along exactly those definitional ambiguities. Future framework design in this theater must explicitly address that failure mode. The strategic calculus here is that Iran has threatened Hormuz closure repeatedly across multiple administrations without executing it. During the 2018 to 2019 maximum pressure campaign, Iranian oil exports fell from approximately 2.5 million barrels per day to under 400,000 barrels per day, and Tehran's response was proxy escalation, not direct closure. Houthi drone strikes on Saudi Aramco facilities, tanker seizures in the Gulf. Iran calibrates Hormuz brinkmanship against actual U.S. naval posture. The current situation replicates that dynamic at a higher kinetic baseline. And the Bab al-Mandeb threat compounds an already degraded Red Sea shipping environment. Houthi interdiction operations have been ongoing since late 2023. A simultaneous closure scenario, even brief, would represent the most severe acute disruption to global energy logistics since the 1973 Arab oil embargo. One second-order variable worth watching closely. Approximately 13% of Chinese energy imports transit Hormuz from Iranian sources. That dependency gives Beijing latent leverage to apply stabilizing back-channel pressure on Tehran without formally endorsing the U.S. position. Whether China exercises that leverage depends entirely on its calculation of U.S. strategic distraction value versus its own energy supply security. That is a calculation Beijing is making right now. On NATO's eastern flank, the German-Netherlands Corps has repositioned from Munster, Germany to Estonia and Latvia. This is not a symbolic gesture. A core-level command and control node is a long lead-time asset. Its pre-positioning communicates to Moscow that Article 5 is not a theoretical construct, but a rehearsed operational reality with pre-positioned infrastructure. The Corps comprises approximately 1,100 permanent personnel, but is designed as a command node capable of coordinating up to 100,000 soldiers under emergency conditions. The operational concept, described by an unnamed NATO military official cited by Estonian World, is mass at speed. The shifting geography of power here is visible in the physical barriers going up along Russia's borders. Lithuania completed Dragon's Teeth anti-tank installations along its Kaliningrad border in August 2025. Latvia deployed dozens of similar barriers in three rows, approximately 10 meters wide. Estonia constructed barriers and gate systems at the Narva Bridge crossing point. The Lieber Institute at West Point characterized this as the most strategically calibrated defensive architecture since the Cold War. The strategic calculus here is explicitly not the Maginot Line's terminal defense. It is Cold War forward defense doctrine, accepting a border fight to buy time for mobile rapid reaction forces rather than ceding ground and counterattacking. Finland's Mannerheim Line in the 1939 to 1940 Winter War demonstrated that well-prepared static defenses combined with difficult terrain can impose disproportionate costs on a larger conventional force. The Baltic states are designing for that same logic, explicitly planning for Article 5 reinforcement to function as their external support. Building on that, Russia's escalatory signaling has intensified in parallel. Security Council Secretary Sergei Shoigu issued a special warning to the Baltic states in May 2025. More significantly, Putin signed legislation authorizing Russian military force to protect Russian citizens abroad facing arrest, trial, detention, or prosecution. Estonia has approximately 80,000 Russian citizens. Latvia has approximately 40,000. The SVR simultaneously alleged falsely, per Latvian denial, that Latvia was preparing Ukrainian drone launch sites at five named military bases. Viewed together, this is a legal and rhetorical scaffolding that closely mirrors the annexation by pretext template employed in Crimea in 2014 and eastern Ukraine in 2022. The pattern has a documented execution history. It is analytically imprudent to dismiss it as purely rhetorical. The Latvia cabinet resignation. The entire government, including Prime Minister Ivika Salina and Defense Minister Andris Sprūds, following a drone incident at a Latvian oil depot, represents a partial hybrid operation success for Moscow. Sub-threshold provocations generating disproportionate domestic political disruption is the doctrine. It is working. Now to the mathematics that may be the most consequential story of the entire briefing. In May 2025, Russian forces conducted over 7,000 ground assault operations, a 38% increase over April's approximately 5,077. Those 7,000-plus assaults yielded approximately 14 square kilometers of territorial gain, at a cost of roughly 30,000 casualties. That equates to approximately 501 assault operations and somewhere between 1,800 and 2,100 Russian personnel lost per square kilometer of territory taken. By NATO's own established defeat standard, 20% casualties rendering a unit combat ineffective, every single Russian assault operation in May 2025 met the definition of defeat. Analysts Chuck Farr and Jason Smart note that the most successful Russian attacks sustained 35% casualties. The upper range reached 85%. Many units were annihilated entirely. Cumulative Russian casualties across the conflict are estimated at approximately 1.35 to 1.4 million. The strategic calculus here is one of structural arithmetic. Russia's estimated 2025 war expenditure is approximately $200 billion, placed against a pre-war GDP that Farr and Smart characterize as smaller than Italy's. That is a structural ceiling on war-making capacity that is not elastic. A pending mobilization decree of approximately 409,000 additional conscripts, with a Putin speech anticipated around June 5th expected to address it, creates a specific analytical signpost. At a sustained casualty rate of roughly 30,000 per month, 409,000 people provides approximately 10 months of manpower to sustain 12 months of combat operations. A structural deficit of approximately 60,000 before accounting for training attrition. More importantly, Putin's 2022 mobilization of approximately 400,000 was accompanied by an estimated 550,000 military-age men leaving Russia who have not returned. Any new mobilization announcement could trigger a comparable emigration response that partially offsets its intended manpower benefit. The Kremlin is aware of this. What it decides to do regardless will be the single most important indicator of how Moscow assesses its own strategic position. On the air domain, Ukraine intercepted approximately 88% of total Russian threats in a recent large-scale overnight strike on Kyiv and Dnipro, 91% of drones, 96% of cruise missiles, but only 33% of ballistic missiles. And air-launched Zircon hypersonic weapons achieved 100% penetration. Russia's A-50 AWACS fleet entering the war at approximately 20 platforms, has had roughly a quarter destroyed with full crew losses and another quarter damaged. A combined attrition rate of approximately 50% of specialized airborne early warning capacity that cannot be reconstituted within any near-term training timeline. Domestic legitimacy indicators are accumulating quietly. In Moscow City Council primaries for United Russia, zero veteran candidates won election. Russian state television has broadcast discussions about relocating disabled veterans to colonies. A veterans advocacy group has formed under the name We Are Not Just Cannon Fodder. These indicators have not reached destabilization thresholds, but they constitute a legitimacy erosion trend that compounds with each month of sustained high casualty operations. One final development that warrants attention as a pattern data point rather than an isolated event. Russia and Afghanistan signed a military technical cooperation agreement in late May, acknowledged at the International Security Forum in Moscow. The agreement's text has not been released. Afghanistan's military capacity renders it of negligible operational value. Global firepower data cited in the source documents. No navy, 5 aircraft, no tanks, no artillery. Approximately 75,000 active military personnel, nearly all required for internal regime maintenance. The agreement's primary strategic function is therefore domestic and performative, projecting diplomatic relevance in a period of mounting isolation, viewed alongside the Assad collapse in Syria, Venezuela's political transition, Iran's leadership succession pressures, and China maintaining the Russia relationship strictly on Beijing's terms. This is a measurable contraction of Moscow's effective sphere of influence. EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaja Kallas stated on May 11th that Putin is in a weaker position than he has ever been. The circumstances of this Taliban agreement appear to substantiate that assessment. By contrast, Ukraine has simultaneously secured decade-long defense partnerships with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, counterparties with genuine financial resources and reciprocal strategic interests in Ukrainian drone defense expertise. That divergence in alliance-building effectiveness is analytically significant and underreported. In the 48 hours ahead, the signal to monitor most closely is the anticipated Putin address around June 5th. Whether he announces, defers, or scales, the 409,000-person mobilization will reveal how the Kremlin actually assesses its own strategic position. Not the position it projects publicly, but the one its central bank and security services are communicating internally. Watch simultaneously for a divergence between Iranian Foreign Ministry statements and IRGC commander statements on the negotiation termination. If those two voices diverge, it indicates internal factional dynamics that could open or close the back-channel window Trump's Truth Social post is pointing toward. Thank you for listening. That's your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. Three theaters. One, connecting thread. Revisionist actors simultaneously overextended and unwilling to recalibrate. Testing an alliance architecture that is hardening faster than Moscow anticipated. We'll have more for you tomorrow. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your CEOR brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.